From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A man whose life's work has offered a window into the lives of the Colusa Indians is being recognized for those efforts. Archaeologist Bill Marquardt receives a Lifetime Achievement Award for his work not only in uncovering the secrets hidden in Southwest Florida's shell mounds, but also for his work in telling that story for future generations. He'll join us to talk about some of his discoveries and what they mean for people living here today. Plus, the holiday break is just a week or so away, meaning the kids will be looking to parents to entertain them. Fear not, there are some camps and other activities on offer in the area. We'll find out about those. Plus, we'll talk with a local educator about why children need a little break and what parents can do to keep kids engaged during their time off. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. 2 solid weeks of having the kids out of school. It's right around the corner, holiday break. It's fun at first, but before boredom sets in, we have a few options to consider, from camps to other activities offered throughout the area. Plus, hear from a local educator about ways to keep your child engaged so they don't spend the whole break zoned out in front of a screen. But first, the name Dr. William Marquardt is likely familiar to anyone who's ever wanted to know more about Florida's ancient past. Dr. Marquardt is an archaeologist who's been digging in Southwest Florida since he was an undergrad, and his decades-long research into the Colusa people, who were the first to live in our area, is one reason he was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Southeastern Archaeological Conference. The award highlights not only his work as a scholar, but also his efforts to be a communicator, interpreting his study of the past to engage and inform the public of today. Dr. Marquardt is currently a curator of South Florida archaeology and ethnography at the Florida Museum of Natural History, a director of the Randall Research Center, and he's also a professor of anthropology at the University of Florida. Dr. Marquardt, welcome to the program. We're talking with Colusa archaeologist Dr. William Marquardt about his study of Florida's earliest inhabitants. Call in with your questions at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Reach out on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU, and you can use the hashtag GCL. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Marquardt.
Glad to be here, Julie.
I wanted to ask you first about how you became interested in studying Florida's people, earliest people, but first, tell me about the ironic relationship that your grandfather shares with the Colusa. I understand that his work in Southwest Florida may have inadvertently destroyed some priceless historical artifacts.
Yeah, that is an interesting story and kind of ironic because my father's first memories back in the 20s were of the thrill of being able to ride as a child on the shell truck that was building roads on Pine Island. And it turns out that my grandfather and grandmother lived on Pine Island along with their 3 young children at that time, including my dad, back in the 20s. And my grandfather was hired to drive the school bus on Pine Island. And then he turned that job over to my grandmother and went to work on the road crews. And so it turns out, ironically, that my grandfather worked on the road crews that were robbing shell middens to build the roads that I'm in, of the mounds that I'm now studying and trying to save. So it's kind of a funny story.
That's kind of ironic. Were you raised out on Pine Island or just your father?
No, I was born and raised in Tampa, and that's where my family's from. So I am a native Floridian, but I didn't really know much about Pine Island until 1983 when I started working on Jocelyn Island. Don and Pat Randell had asked to have that island surveyed for archaeological resources, and that was the first time I'd actually gotten on an archaeological site in Southwest Florida. It was 1983.
And that's what sparked your interest?
Yeah, I was pretty fascinated from the very beginning, and I saw it was a very different environment than what I was used to. I started learning about the plants and the animals and the fishes and how the environment worked. I just became really fascinated with it, and the Colusa Indians themselves are an interesting story. They were a complex, very well-established, powerful political organization when the Spaniards arrived, and they controlled all of South Florida from an area there in Estero Bay near Fort Myers Beach. But they were fishing people. They were not agriculturists. They didn't raise corn or manioc or any of those things. So they're really an interesting group. So the combination of the Colusa being an interesting anthropological puzzle, and just I was just swept away by the marvelous environment down there, made me kind of hooked, I guess, from the beginning.
Well, they are pretty interesting. The popular conception is that the Colusa people didn't leave many artifacts because they didn't create things like pottery. But what kind of things do you find or have you found, and what stories can you extract from that?
Well, actually, they left quite a bit of pottery. It's just that the pottery is not very fancy. So people who are, I guess, appreciate the really well-made, beautifully decorated pottery sort of discount the Colusa. But they made a lot of pottery. They cooked in pots. They stored their food in pots and so forth. But we know from some specific sites, particularly one down on Marco Island, that Colusa people of this time were artists. They carved wooden objects. They painted. They were very artistic in many ways. So some of the best-known artifacts of Southwest Florida are actually made of wood, not of ceramics.
Did they trade pottery with other parts of Florida?
Yes, absolutely. They started trading with the people in the Belleglade area, which is around Lake Okeechobee, as early as 200 to 400 A.D., and we call this Belleglade pottery. And over the years, they became better and better associated with or attached to those people in that area. And so by, they say, about 1,000 years ago, that Belleglade pottery is the dominant kind of pottery that they used. So not only did they trade pottery, but I think they had intricate working relationships and trading relationships with people in the interior and up and down the coast. When you live in an area where you depend on fish and shellfish for your daily sustenance, well, of course they had some other things too, but really their main dietary staple for protein was fish. If the fish isn't good for a while, you need to depend on other people to help you out. And then it works the other way around. It's reciprocity. So people in the interior could depend on the Colusa to help them out, or the Colusa could depend on the people in the interior to help them out when things weren't going so well. So there's all kinds of advantages to trading relationships and political relationships with people that are not exactly where you're living.
What would you imagine it was like dealing with the Colusa if you had a trade meeting, if you were from the interior and you're going to go meet the Colusa? What kind of people were these that you would see meet them?
Well, the Spaniards describe them as tall, beautiful people. They're very strong. And, of course, the Spaniards were pretty short people at the time, so that doesn't mean the Colusa were giants. It just means they were taller than the Spaniards. They have a kind of a reputation, the Colusa do, for being fierce people or strong warriors, and indeed they were. They did enforce their will from time to time, especially late and just before the Spaniards arrived. But I imagine they would be very fierce competitors. But on the other hand, we all need other people, and you need to establish relationships. If you can't really depend on being by yourself all the time, you really need other people to build reciprocal relations. And so I suspect that the meeting would have been formal, and there would have been tea served, a kind of a black drink, which is made of a plant that grows locally in the coast of Florida. There might have been ceremonies and singing, but it might have happened, because we have some historical accounts of that. Welcoming ceremonies would be made. But basically, they were a practical people, too. They weren't just having ceremonies and having meetings all the time. They got up every morning and went fishing and made things. And, you know, you can't go to the hardware store and buy your netting and your cordage and your canoe or whatever. You have to make all those things. So, you know, they were very busy people, as well as people who were sophisticated in their art and in their political arrangements.
What kind of structures did they make for their living arrangements?
Well, we think that they lived in wooden and thatched structures. People maybe have been in the Everglades and have seen Seminole structures. Seminole structures tend to be open-sided. We suspect that the Colusa ones were not. And we have what archaeologists call post moles, which means a stain in the earth where you can see where a post for support structure for a house was. Well, we think they made them out of a wood and then thatch with the local sable palm thatch for roofs. We recently worked on Mound Key, which is was the Calusa capital at the time the Spaniards arrived, and we found very good evidence there of the house that belonged to the king that the Spaniards report was large enough for 2,000 people to stand inside. That was in 1566 when Pedro Menendez de Aviles came to visit the Calusa king there.
2,000 people?
Yeah, that's what the Spaniards say. Now, we wondered about that, but the curvature of the building, we didn't excavate the whole thing, but the curvature of the building as we understand it could be quite a large structure, and it looks like it was rebuilt at least once. So we're still working on that to figure out how big it was, but it certainly would have held a lot of people, and it would have been a very impressive structure. And in fact, a guy named Solis de Meras, who was the secretary and the nephew, actually, of Pedro Menendez, writes about that meeting in some detail, so we know what the interior of the building was like and so forth. So it's, you know, there were sophisticated architects. There were people who were able to get by just fine with their skills that they had, and they traveled widely in their canoes, and they built canals that would connect their sites to one another. So this is a pretty sophisticated people.
Yeah, that's complex engineering, really.
It really is.
We are talking with archaeologist Dr. William Marquardt about his research into the Calusa people of Southwest Florida and his recent Lifetime Achievement Award from the Southeastern Archaeological Conference. If you have any questions or if you'd like to give us a call, 877-428-8255 or 877-GCU-TALK. You can also catch us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet us at WGCU with the hashtag of GCL. So your research says that the year 800 was a turning point toward more complexity in the Calusa culture. So what happened around that time, or how did it become more complex?
Well, the time between about 500 and 800 AD was a challenging time climatically. We have evidence that there was a sea level fluctuation which would have emptied a lot of the water out of Pine Island Sound. When you're dependent on a shallow estuary like the Calusa were, it's difficult when the fish leave. I mean, the fish are just going to go to deeper waters and not, you know, be around anymore. So if you're dependent on near shore fishing with nets then you're going to be in big trouble. So you can again withstand short term fluctuations. And again, you could depend on people that in the interior or up and down the coast to help out. But when you get a period where the climate is really getting cooler year by year, with fluctuations, yes, but overall getting cooler, then you're going to have less and less fish. And so they actually abandoned one of the largest sites, Pineland, in that time period. Then, as climate warmed up again in what's called the medieval warm period, moving into 900-1000 AD, they came back, the fish came back basically, and the water was there again, and they began to consolidate and build their mounds up higher. Partly I think this was a water control issue, because the sea level was rising so rapidly that they began to orient their houses and their settlement structure in kind of a different way, and they started building these canals. At Pineland, we have good evidence of a canal being built about that time, and then another canal around probably 1,000 to 1,200 AD that went all the way across Pine Island, 2.5 miles, with all kinds of access to the interior much easier. So there's a lot of ways that we can tell how climate changed, and it's not just that climate entirely drives culture, because people do make decisions about what to do, but it is a time that a lot of things were changing in the world, as the medieval Europe is also warming, and throughout the southeastern United States, people are increasing their populations, and the Tampa Bay area, the Tocobaga, were becoming stronger and more prosperous, and so the Calusa are no exception to that.
Well, it's pretty interesting how you can watch their movements and how they evolved, where they chose to live, and how that can tell you the story of how the climate was influencing some of their decisions and how it kind of moved their culture.
Yeah, one of the things that we do as a interdisciplinary team, meaning we work with people of not just archaeologists, but other people who know other things as well, we call it historical ecology. And what we mean by that is that we prefer to look at people and their relationship with the environment. So environment does influence our choices. It gives us opportunities, but it also provides challenges from time to time. People can also influence their environment and change it in certain ways. Then there's also the idea that environment is not just the raw material out there, not the rocks or the water or the mountains or whatever it is that you have around you, but it's what you think it is. So it's how people perceive the environment. So if one person looks at a mountain and sees a mountain and another person sees it as a sacred mountain, you know, that's a perception of what's out there that is different. So you interact with the environment based on what you think it is and what your vested interests are, economically, socially, or religiously.
It sounds like your approach to archaeology is a bit more all-encompassing than people that are not involved might imagine. Instead of working in a vacuum of only thinking archaeology, you're also thinking about climate change and environment and things like that. So perhaps this is one of the contributing reasons to why you received this Lifetime Achievement Award. So congratulations definitely for that.
Well, I appreciate that. It was a big surprise to me. This is the Southeastern Archaeological Conference, as it sounds, all the archaeologists who work in the southeastern United States. So it's an organization that I respect, and this is the highest achievement award that they give. But, you know, these kind of things are not done by oneself. I couldn't have done any of this without the colleagues I have to work with, the students here at the University of Florida and other places, and just hundreds of volunteers from Southwest Florida who have contributed to our work over the years from the very earliest times. We had volunteers in 1983 on Jocelyn Island, and we still work with volunteers today. And I couldn't have done any of that without those folks to help. Also, we couldn't do the work without our colleagues. I would mention Mike Savarese there at your place, Florida Gulf Coast University. We've recently published a paper together with some colleagues from University of Georgia where he was able to demonstrate with our help and with work from archaeological materials as well as what he had gathered himself, we were able to demonstrate that the Colusa people had an impact on the oysters in the harbor there in Estero Bay and Pine Island Sound, but they did not have an impact enough to endanger the oyster population on the long term. Things like this are useful for providing that kind of detail, sensitive information on how people affect the environment and how the environment affects people. And, you know, as we work toward restoration of the Everglades or any other kind of natural environment, there's a tendency for the engineers who are doing the restoration to try to restore it to a particular time. And what our research is helping to demonstrate is those things are not necessarily static, that people affect the environment. The environment has changed quite a bit over time, and so we can give a long-term perspective that way to help people understand and allow for the fluctuations that we're going to see in the future, because they've been there in the past as well. So really, it's nice to have an award. Everybody likes to be recognized, but honestly, I couldn't have done any of that without my colleagues and my students and all the volunteers who help out.
Well, another thing that's pointed out is that you're not just being recognized for your efforts, but you also are great at engaging the public with outreach and tourism programs. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those programs, and how do people react when you first tell them about the Colusa when they hadn't heard much about them before?
Well, I think some people just imagine that the Colusa were people like the Colusa were everywhere, and when you start talking to people about how they were really quite remarkable, some of the things I've already mentioned today, they were, you know, very powerful, artistic, accomplished, complex people without being agriculturists, and how the environment has nurtured them and still nurtures us today. I think people do make the connection and see that the Colusa are pretty special, but then so is Pine Island Sound, Charlotte Harbor, Estero Bay, the whole estuarine system, the rivers, the waters there are. They nurture us today just as much, whether you're a person in the tourism industry or the hospitality industry, or you like to go fishing, or you know, you're part of the economy of Lee County there, or Collier County. or Charlotte County, you depend in some ways on the health of that estuary. So I think that's part of our message is, hey, look, you know, it nurtured the Colusa, but it nurtures you today as well. We first started doing this kind of public outreach during a project we called the Year of the Indian back in 1989 to 1992. And we started having school programs for Lee County school children to come out and see the site, and they had been prepared in their classrooms beforehand to what they were going to see. And what we realized was that a lot of the school kids who came out there not only didn't know much about the Colusa or their past before kind of their grandmother or whatever, but that they didn't know much about the environment either. Some of them would get out of the school bus and just stare at the water because they had never seen the water before. And some of these are, you know, not just kids from underprivileged backgrounds, but middle-class kids and so forth. And they just had no knowledge of the coast, and they live in a coastal county. And so that was kind of an epiphany for us. We started saying, wow, you know, we need to be not just talking about the Colusa and maybe the history of this area. We need to be talking about the environment as well, because people need to know these things. And so we were able to get a donation of the property that Pineland is situated on there, actually about 58 acres of it. Ultimately, we control that property now. Part of it's state property, part of it's leased from Lee County. But anyway, this is what we call the Randell Research Center. It's located right there at Pineland. And we have just year by year a little bit of help from a lot of people. We managed to establish a research and education center there. And you can go, anybody can go there on any day. Park your car and walk the site. It's a nice, comfortable walk. We call it the Colusa Heritage Trail. And you can walk by 13 museum-quality signs that interpret what we've learned there over the 30 years or so we've been working there. You can stand on top of a 30-foot-high Colusa Indian mound and look out over the site. And this is the place that was the second-largest town of the Colusa Indians. We call it Pineland today. It was called Tampa, actually, in the original Colusa language.
Oh, that's interesting. But when you go out there, I mean, these signs, I'm sure, are pretty useful, because to the layman looking out over that area, they probably wouldn't see much of anything unless they knew what they were looking at with those signs.
Yeah, it's a pretty place. I mean, even if you didn't have the archaeology, we've documented over 100 species of birds on the site over the years. And, you know, there are butterflies and birds and wildlife of all sorts and pretty trees and nice native vegetation. So there's a lot to see out there, even if there wasn't an archaeological site. But, yes, I think other than the mounds, which are pretty remarkable, if you live in Southwest Florida, you're not used to 30-foot-high hills, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, but people would notice those, I think. But other than that, yeah, I think it does help. And it's a non-threatening environment. You can walk around these well-marked trails and take your time and, you know, even walk your dog. If you have a leash on your dog, we welcome animals too. So, you know, we have a gift shop there and a good selection of books on Southwest Florida archaeology and history, a classroom where we have exhibits about what's been found in the area and replicated artifacts. And during January through April, we have guided tours twice a day. So it's really a nice place to come for people. And more than that, in addition to that, I should say, we have about 1,000 school kids that still come to the site every year, both private and public schools. And we have some programs to help schools that don't have the budget to do that. So it's still going on. You know, we started this back in the early 90s, really. It's really worth doing, I think. And not only is it a pretty place to come and a nice place to bring your kids or your visitors from out of town or whatever, but I think it's doing a good job at letting people know that their environment is pretty special and that the Colusa is special and their history is special. It's not just like everybody else's history.
Yeah, it is a very unique history. I wanted to backtrack just a second, because I'm curious, why did they never do extensive agriculture? They grew a few things, but why did they never do any more in the way of agriculture?
Yeah, that's a good question. I just don't feel like they ever, I don't believe they ever felt like they had a need for it, Julie. It's just that they were so dependent on the fish and the shellfish, and, well, they did have some squash and chili peppers and papaya and lots of wild plants that they used. So it's not that they didn't have plants to use. They had plenty of that, too. But they just, you know, the Spaniards even tried to convince them to be agriculturists. They just laughed at them. They said, take those hoes away. We don't know how to do anything with those. You'll have to bring your own people to use those hoes. You know, they just were not interested.
They were not into it.
They were not into Spanish religion, and they were not into Spanish or agriculture. They just weren't farmers.
Now, what happened when the Europeans got here?
Well, the Europeans started probably slaving in South Florida long before Ponce de Leon arrived. But once that happened, it cemented their suspicion of the Europeans. They drove Ponce de Leon away in 1513, again in 1519. They were very hostile to the Spaniards. Later, they tried to kind of accommodate the Spaniards. In 1560s, they tried to do that, but it didn't work. And they repelled Jesuit and Franciscan efforts to missionize them. People always wanted them to do something different than they wanted to do. You know, they had their own religion and their own traditions, and they knew what they were doing. And everybody was always trying to change them, you know, make them into something else. So,
what was that religion that they had?
Well, it was a religion that had a Trinity. It had an overall creator of the universe. It had a secondary God who controlled politics and societies and people, and a tertiary war god that they could pray to in times of battle, and he would favor you if he thought you were worthy or whatever. They also believed in an immortal soul. They had three souls actually in the body, two of which disappeared at the time of death, but one of which lasted forever, which was located in the pupil of the eye. And they would go to the graveside after people had been buried and actually speak to their dead. And they said that they got information from their ancestors, from their dead, on what was going on other places and what was going to happen in the future. So they had a very, massed processions of priests. They had synchronized singing by young women. There's just a lot of complicated, complex spiritual beliefs that they had. And so you can imagine Spaniards walk in with their own very complicated religion, and they just said, well, you know, that's okay for you, but we're not interested in that. And that confounded the Spaniards. They just couldn't imagine people wouldn't want to just immediately embrace everything European.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Yeah, it was a Eurocentric for sure, definitely.
Absolutely.
Just as we are kind of present-centric, we look at things like you were saying, the evolution and climate change and things that have impacted these cultures that you have discovered, that over time we seem to think because we're here now, things have changed only within our lifetime, but things have been changing for a very long time. And that's one of the overriding messages that it seems that you bring to the study of archaeology in our area.
Yes, I think that is true. And if we've done that, then I think everything that we've done as a team here has been successful. And, it is, the past is dynamic. The present is dynamic. Things are happening that are somewhat predictable, and other things are happening that are not so predictable. And we always need to look toward the past to see what has changed in the past, what mistakes have been made, what opportunities were taken advantage of that worked out. You know, and to be aware, I think, of those things and see how people-environment relations have been dynamic and how how we can learn from that in our present lives.
To give us a better understanding of the present and also dealing with the future.
Absolutely.
Well, that's all the time we have, so I'm going to wrap it up right there. Thank you, Dr. Marquardt, for joining us today and for all the work that you do. Also, congratulations on your Lifetime Achievement Award.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you. Coming up, the holiday break from school is looming large on the horizon. Have you made plans for your child? We'll have some ideas to keep your unoccupied student from getting too bored over the winter vacation. Next.